I would like to start today on a kind of six-part series of talks, probably over the next 6-7 weeks or so. Next week, I'll probably give more of a Halloween-style talk, whatever that is. And the series I wanted to talk about is the hindrances, a very interesting topic for meditators, usually sometimes called the five hindrances. And today I'd like to do a kind of introduction to the hindrances, and then over this part of the series is to take each of the five one Sunday morning and go in a little more detail on the particular hindrances. And the hindrances are those, that functioning of the mind, which hinders our ability to see clearly, that hinders our ability to be concentrated and focused in the present moment. It's the functioning of the mind that hinders or clouds our ability to see clearly what is for our own benefit and what is for our harm. Be able to see, this would be good for me to do, or this is not good for me to do. And there's five of these things, and actually there's seven hindrances, but there are two pairs. So there's five hindrances, but within that list, two of them are paired up, so you get five. And the speculation for why there's five rather than seven, why they're lumped together in five, is that for those of you who might know about this, is to correlate the five hindrances with the five jhanic factors. And so each of the jhanic factors is an antidote to each of the hindrances. So the these five are sensual desire, ill will, and then a famous expression, sloth and torpor. I'm sure it's a word, and you regularly use that expression, sloth and torpor. When's the last time you had sloth? So told your friend, call up your friend and say, hey, you know, today I'm filled with sloth. My son loves the animals, sloth animals. And then sloth and torpor, and then restlessness and agitation, or restlessness and worry, and the fifth one is doubt. And what's important to understand is that each of these qualities in and of themselves is not a hindrance. What's a hindrance is when we're so caught by them that then the healthy functioning of the mind, the clear seeing of the mind, is not able to operate because we're caught by one of these five or one of these seven forces. And I call them kind of the black holes of the mind, because a black hole is this kind of, you know, star that's collapsed, I guess. And the gravitational force is so powerful that light goes through by it, comes close to it, and gets sucked in and never comes out. And so when the hindrances are operating, the light of awareness, you know, gets close to it and gets sucked in, and eventually it comes out, I guess, but sometimes it can be a long time where we're kind of lost in this. So the five hindrances are very important. The Buddha put a lot of emphasis on their importance, that in order for the meditative path of Buddhism to really click or really work for a person, whether it's to develop concentration or develop mindfulness, the hindrances need to stop hindering. And that's kind of obvious, you know. The mind has to be able to see clearly in order for the meditative practice to work. And so if the mind is not seeing clearly, then it's not going to work properly. So a lot of what meditators are addressing, especially earlier in their practice, but often throughout, is learning to recognize the hindrances, learning how to work with them. And you find a lot of talks given, especially if you go on meditation retreats. There's usually one talk or retreat given on the five hindrances. I think that it's the duty or the responsibility or the task of people who meditate or practice mindfulness to become connoisseurs of the hindrances, to become experts on them, to kind of, I like to say, study them so well you can write a PhD dissertation on them. Look for opportunities to study them. And that means a kind of inviting attitude towards them. Rather than at the first approach, think, oh, this is bad, it shouldn't be happening. Say, well, oh, look, here I am, I'm caught. What is this like? To study it, to investigate, to get to know it. Because by really understanding something well, then there can be a lot more. It's a lot easier to find your freedom if you know something really well. If you don't know something really well, or kind of dismiss a bit of, let go of it too quickly, you don't really get to know it, and you don't really learn how to be free of it. So the task of on the hindrance is to get to know them really well. And the story that I've talked already about this week sometimes is when Mara is kind of like the Buddhist tempter or devil. And Mara's job description is to prevent people from getting enlightened. And Mara comes to visit the Buddha after he's enlightened, causing trouble. And every time Mara comes, in the suttas as it's described, all Mara does is say, "Mara, I see you." And Mara runs away. There's something very powerful in the act of seeing that can somehow liberate us from inner psychic forces of confusion and doubt and desire and ill will and fear. Something about seeing. But the reason why the Buddha's statement, "Mara, I see you," is so powerful is the Buddha really knows Mara well. He really knows Mara very thoroughly. In that thorough knowing of something, there's freedom to be found. So in mindfulness practice, we talk a lot about learning to see clearly what's here and develop that capacity to see clearly. But seeing clearly can be done with different depths of understanding. So, for example, a person can see the arising of desire. Oh, there's desire. I see it. Or a person can really understand the nature of desire. So when they see desire, it's not just seeing desire itself, but knows how desire works in our lives, knows how the dangers of desire, knows what triggered the rising of desire, what it takes to kind of let desire kind of fade away, what it takes to learn how not to be hooked by desire, to learn a lot of different things. You really know desire inside and out. Then when you see it, there's a lot more power, penetration, or freedom possible because you really know it. And sometimes in our tradition of mindfulness, people sometimes are too content with just seeing, because mindfulness is kind of just seeing what's happening in the present moment. And the comprehension, the clear understanding, isn't as strongly emphasized. But part of what we want to do is we not only want to learn the ability to see in a clear, non-reactive way the present moment, but we also want to develop our understanding so we really comprehend deeply what we're seeing. So the study of this is part of this, part of the practice, the reflection on it, getting to know these things really well. So a couple of similes that are used in the ancient text. One is a simile of how it is that mindfulness prevents clear seeing. And that is, if you want to look at a pond of water and see your reflection in the water, the pond needs to be really still and clean, I suppose, and really flat and still. And if you don't have it, if you're not clear and still, you can't see yourself clearly. When sensual desire is operating, it's like taking a dye and coloring the water. So that when you look into the water, you don't see yourself clearly, but you see yourself red or blue or whatever the color of the dye is. Doesesn't take a lot of reflection to realize that sometimes when we're in the really grips of desire, that sometimes we don't see clearly, but we see in a colored way. When we're in the grips of lust, sometimes everybody is just, you know, attractive. I don't know if that's a good example, but, you know, that person is, you know, all we see about that person is that person's, you know, beautiful qualities. Because desire kind of put that lens on. So it's said that when you have desire, we don't see clearly because there's a filter through which we see. When there's ill will present, then it's like having the water of the pond boil. And the surface of the water is just boiling. And they can't see clearly. And probably some of you have been in the grips of anger and you feel the heat going and boiling and being consumed by it. And you don't see clearly because of the boiling. When there's sloth and torpor, it's like algae growing across the surface of the pond. And it's just kind of, you don't see it all because it's all this kind of, you know, just so mucky. And then Restlessness and anxiety is like the wind blowing across the surface of the pond, agitating it and kind of keeping it kind of tossed up and churned up. And that prevents clear seeing. And then the fifth one, doubt, it's like the pond being filled with mud. It's just like really thick and gooey and, you know, just everything's kind of, you know, thick and maybe not even reflective. And you try to go through it and just kind of like you can't hardly go through the water. So five analogies for one of the ways in which showing that these hindrances have an effect on our ability to see. Sometimes the hindrances are so powerful, there's very little seeing at all. We're kind of lost in them. And that happens especially in meditation, where we enter into a kind of fantasy world, a thought world around the hindrances, and then we get lost in those thoughts. And it might take 5, 10 minutes or longer before we come out of it because we're so lost in those thoughts. It might be useful as you're kind of reflecting on these hindrances to think about extreme examples. Sensual desire, addiction. We have a society, a lot of people where addiction is a real problem. And what it's like to be in the grips of addictive state of mind. Or extreme states of hate or anger. What's that like, you know, and how that functions in our lives. And then as a spiritual practice develops, the sensitivity to the hindrances becomes more and more subtle. So that hindrances that might operate in daily life, which hardly seem to be an issue, in meditation become a really big issue. Because meditation, your mind becomes very, very sensitive to any of the subtle pulls away from seeing clearly and the subtle pulls from being balanced and centered here in the present moment. If a person doesn't have any hindrances, you don't need to come to the series. But if you have hindrances, then you might think of yourself as naturalists. That this is really interesting. Something happens in the mind, and it'd be interesting to get to know it better. That's fascinating. It's like, you know, you go to a museum and you study certain things. So now we're studying this wonderful animal, so, you know, these wonderful things. Ancient things and antiques, the hindrances. And it's useful, I think, to think of the hindrances as not being personal qualities. That the hindrance is something that everybody has, and to different degrees at different times. And many people, when they notice these qualities of being hindered or caught, they take it very personally. But part of the teachings of the Buddhism is that human beings have hindrances. That's partly how the mind functions. And rather than taking it personally, taking it as being as a universal quality we all share, and the task is to understand them well, so that there can be some freedom. So in terms of comprehending and seeing the hindrance as well, the discourse in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is the kind of like the foundational teaching of the Buddha for our center here, for how we teach mindfulness, what we do, has a whole section on the hindrances. And it has a number of suggestions about what we can do in paying attention to the hindrances so we understand them well. The first is to understand their presence, when they're present. And, you know, if you can really see that you're caught by desire, when you're caught by desire, then you're not quite caught. Then you're a little bit free from it. But if you don't even see that you're caught, look out. If you see that you're caught by one of the hindrances, or all of them, sometimes they appear together, a good rule to live by that I found is don't make a decision when you're caught by hindrance. If you're filled with lust or greed or desire for something, or filled with animosity and anger and ill will, or filled with restlessness and anxiety, or just really kind of lethargic and tired, or filled with doubt, it's best not to make a decision about something. I've known a lot of people who made decisions in that kind of state and later regretted it. Partly because the reason not to make a decision is that in big decisions is that we're seeing things through the filter of that hindrance. We're not seeing clearly. So the idea is to wait until we see clearly. So the first task is to see that we're caught by any hindrance that's operating. And then to see it clearly for what it is. And in our particular tradition of meditation, we put a lot of emphasis on clear seeing, non-reactive seeing. The kind of seeing that's kind of, in some ways, some people talk about it being accepting awareness, that just sees it for what it is. When we train ourselves or learn how not to react to the presence of something. We're not pushing it away, we're not grabbing hold of it, we're not getting reactive to the it's there. So we see anger arise, for example, and rather than being angry that we're angry or embarrassed that we're angry or jump on the justification wagon, I'm justified in anger and these are all the reasons why, just, this anger has arisen and let's just see it. And something very powerful can happen, that kind of non-reactive awareness that sees something as it is. However, in the discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the Buddha goes further than just says, see the hindrance for what it is when it's there. The Buddha also says, know when the hindrance is absent. And that's a very interesting thing also, because I think many times people hear the instructions of mindfulness, and it sounds like the instructions, just notice what is here. You know, notice the absence of something, that's not here, right? So what's the point of that? But here the Buddha says, also know when the hindrances are not present. I think it has a number of values. One is, if we can feel clearly how we are when the hindrance is not operating, we have a contrast for seeing when the hindrances are operating. And that contrast helps us to really understand the hindrances. We can catch them earlier, we can understand them, we can see the effect they have on us. We can see how we're different when we have them and when we don't have them. So to be able to study a little bit what it's like to be without them is important. Also, but you don't have to go around all the time, you know, noting it's not happening now, it's not happening now. You know, just occasionally. But it's particularly helpful to notice when the hindrance has just passed away. You're caught in the grip of one of these, and then for some reason or other, it's no longer there. And then notice, it's gone. And that has a couple of values. One is the value of contrast. One is the value is when you recognize a healthy state, the healthy state gets strengthened. It's part of the power of recognition. But the third, that's very important, is that there's a kind of a joy that can come when you recognize the absence of a hindrance. When the hindrance, we're not caught or gripped or lost in a hindrance. I mean, it's nice not to be caught, right? To have the mind kind of free. And if you notice that the hindrance is gone, and then avail yourself of the kind of natural, hopefully natural, kind of delight or joy, look, I'm free. That joy is a factor which feeds meditation, feeds the Buddha's spiritual life. So that's one of the reasons to notice its absence, so we can take advantage of the joy that can come, or the delight, or the appreciation of that. Now the simile the Buddha gave for appreciating the absence of the hindrances, well, he gave some similes. And as you listen to these similes, you might think about extreme cases of being caught. Maybe the times you were most powerfully caught by sensual desire. You know, you kind of just, you did foolish things because you just couldn't help yourself and just such a struggle. Or ill will or anger or any of these. Or if it doesn't really happen to you, imagine someone else. to be free of sensual desire is like being free from debt. And some people are certainly heavily troubled by debt, and really it feels great to be free of it. But somehow, a sensual desire—it's like we're investing someplace else. We're taking our energy, and we're kind of putting it someplace else, we're draining ourselves. And when we're long in the grip of desire, we found ourselves again. We kind of, become wealthy again, rather than feeling poor and feeling in need of something. Freedom from desire is freedom from debt. Freedom from ill will is like being free of an illness or a wound. And sometimes when you feel a lot of anger, it's like being sick. You can actually feel sick inside. People get heart attacks sometimes if you get angry enough. So being freed from ill will is like being freed from an illness. Being freed from sloth and torpor is like, we'll skip it since I don't remember right now. I'll stretch my mind in a minute. Being free from restlessness and agitation is like being freed from a prison. Because if you're agitated and restless, it's kind of directing the show. It's like you're not in charge. You're kind of imprisoned by this stuff. And freedom from doubt is, I don't know why I don't remember these right now, is, being free from danger. And the danger that's in the simile is like you're lost in the desert. And then finally you find safety after being lost in the desert. So the doubt can be like, you know, a desert-like quality. And finally you're free from this desert, flat, kind of barren situation. So sloth and torpor is... I think sloth and torpor, yeah, is slavery, like being freed from slavery. You know, you kind of weigh down, the chains are heavy, and you can't do much. So when these things are really strong and they're absent, then there can be a joy that gets born. For meditators, I think that the appreciation of the absence of hindrances can be for even subtle hindrances. To discover the great delight of a mind that's clear and present and awake and here, and not being swayed this way and that way by these forces, is really one of the great things in human life, the clarity that can happen. So to feel the delight and the happiness of that. So in the next three instructions that the Buddha gave around getting to know the hindrances as well, have to do with understanding the causes and conditions around them. So to understand something about what is it that triggers the arising of a hindrance? What triggers your mind getting caught, being hindered and lost? For example, perhaps you get the paper in the morning and you read it, and you find yourself, you know, the next 3-4 hours really caught up in stock market thoughts and greed and desire and fear and all that. And you realize that every morning what you do is you turn to the stock market page and look and see how your favorite stocks are doing. And it just kind of like triggers your preoccupation with stocks. And maybe it's not useful to be in the grips of financial preoccupation for 3-4 hours every morning until it kind of wears off and you can start your day. Do you see how that causes the arising of that particular caughtness? Desire. You know, if you spend all morning, all Sunday morning, it's phenomenal the number of advertisements that come in the Sunday paper. It should be illegal, I think. You spend all morning kind of looking through all the advertisements. And then you wonder why the next 2-3 hours you're filled with desire for things. It's been a trigger for it. So to start seeing... what is the triggers? What is the conditions, the soil for which you're likely to get caught in one of these hindrance attacks? So that takes some analysis or some reflection or some thinking. It's more than just seeing clearly. It's when a hindrance has arisen, to spend some time reflecting on it, thinking about what's going on here, what was that about? Or even when it's past, no longer there, stop and think, what was that about? What's going on there? Or if you sit in meditation, you don't want to think so much in meditation, but when you come out of meditation and you've spent a session kind of caught in the hindrances, spend some time reflecting and thinking, maybe talking to friends about your experience of being caught in the grips of sloth and torpor during that last session of meditation, or if it happens regularly. So you spend some, and maybe read some books about it and explore it, get to know it. Spend some intelligent time trying to understand the nature of what triggers the arising of the hindrance. When the hindrances do arise, then understand what it takes to become free of that caughtness. What does it take for you to become free? So when you're in trouble, know how to get out of trouble. Pretty good advice, right? So one of the things we do in our tradition is we cultivate awareness. So a clear recognition. There's something about awareness, if it's strong enough and clear enough, dedicated enough, that can pull us out of the muck, out of the black hole. We have a counterforce to the force of the hindrances, and we use awareness. That sometimes works. Sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes we use antidotes. So sloth and desire and ill will, it said that it tends to arise when we have a kind of prejudiced view of what we have desire or ill will towards. With desire, we tend to overvaluate the beautiful qualities or the good qualities, the thing we want. With ill will, we tend to overevaluate the bad qualities or invent them. And so one simple antidote, when there's desire, look at the situation and look at the, I don't know if I want to use the word bad, but the kind of the bad qualities of that thing. If you're caught in ill will, then look at the good qualities, the beautiful qualities. So you know, can look back and forth. So I know, you know, one classic antidote for lust, when you really lust after someone's body, is you imagine, you know, you guys have good imaginations. So, okay, well, leave it to that. And when you have ill will for someone, then you imagine their beauty. You know, and find what's beautiful about them, their good qualities. So to start having strategies, understanding ways of dealing with these hindrances when they've arisen. Because who wants to stay caught? You know, if you're really caught, find a way to get out of trouble. And then the third kind of comprehension understanding is to know how to prevent the arising of hindrances in the future. So the first is to know why it arose when it arisen, the causes and conditions for it, to know how to get out of trouble when you're in trouble, and then prevent yourself from getting in trouble in the future. The preventive medicine. Preventive medicine. So, you know, don't open the paper in the morning, you know, or the stock markets. They don't read the financial section if that's what catches you, or, you know, be much more judicious how you read advertisements. So, you know, you figure out better examples. So five hindrances, or seven hindrances under five categories. The beginning of freedom in meditation is to be free of these five, so they're not operating. And the way to do that is to begin study them, get to know them, learn about them really well. And the better you know them, the more likely you'll be able to be free of them. The less you know them and they operate, the less you'll be able to be free from it. So those are my thoughts. So maybe not next week, but maybe the following weeks, I'll go over each of those five sets one by one, and we can explore them and get to know them. So now it's your turn. Do you have any questions or comments about this? Please.
I know when I get caught in my compulsions, it's a very physical sense, and I find that kind of a block to trying to understand it, because the physicality of it, where you feel like you just want to burst out of your skin, is difficult.
So the restlessness is quite physical. The correlation between this restlessness and anxiety is one is physical and the other is mental. And sloth and torpor, one is physical and one is mental. So restlessness is more, so you say it's more physical, that's right. And so you feel like you're crawling out of your skin or about to burst or bolt for the door or something. And it can be very hard. Occasionally in meditation, it can feel like you're in the rodeo. And a successful session of meditation is when you didn't leave your seat before the end of the time. That's success. I mean, literally, you don't measure success by great clarity and freedom and great cosmic bliss or anything. When the hindrance, when you're really in a powerful grip of restlessness, the fact that you hung in there and didn't fall off the horse, that's really great. And it takes a lot. Sometimes you might break into a sweat. You know, I'm going to stay here no matter what. It's very powerful to do that. I find that one of the most effective things to do with restlessness is to feel it physically. And just to let the energy of restlessness move through the body, course through the body, kind of open the gates in the body to let it move through. But be committed, for example, not to move. So there's kind of this not moving, but let the energy flow. And then not believe the thoughts that are connected to it. Not act on the impulses and motivations. With restlessness, with desire and ill will in particular, there's a practice I recommend, which I call, with desire, writing out the desire, writing it out. People who have very strong addictions find this very useful. Their strong desire can arise, powerful, and within grips of it. You know, I need that cigarette right now. And then you commit yourself to not acting. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to hang out here and be with it and not act on it. So maybe get in meditation posture and sit, or sit down in a chair or something. And then watch everything that happens. Watch a tremendous surge of energy that can happen. And watch all the powerful thoughts and feelings in the mind that can happen. And the sense of compulsion and necessity and imminence. It has to be now or else. Now. And the mind will muster all its lawyers, you know, to argue its case. And all its advertisers to allure you. But you stay there. I'm not going to move. And sooner or later, the desire passes. It's guaranteed. I guarantee. You get money back guarantee. And sooner or later, maybe later, the desire will pass away. And the wave will break. And when the wave breaks and you find yourself on the other side, it's very empowering. It produces a lot of confidence for people. Wow, I can do it. I was able to kind of not give in to those powerful impulses and compulsions. I was able to be separate from that, not identify with it so strongly. And if I just stayed still, eventually it passed. And if you do that a few times, then over time it becomes easier and easier. So with restlessness, it might be that way too. So you might try, you know, sit still and see, you know, how long it takes. You know, just, okay, I'm committed to sit here until the restlessness passes. That's one thing to do. And there's a lot of other things to do around restlessness. And sometimes there's an emotional root for the restlessness. And so you might have to go and pay attention to the root. So for example, a common one is anxiety or fear. And so it might be more useful sometimes not to feel it physically, but to feel it emotionally, and then do mindfulness of that emotion. So we'll talk more about that in a few weeks. Please. Well, sometimes hindrances are strategies for the mind to avoid discomfort, or avoid something. And so if there's expectation or there's a desire or some clinging to some outcome and the outcome is not happening, that's an uncomfortable situation. So we get frustrated and then ill will can arise. Or further desire can arise as a result. If sometimes when people feel some sense of discomfort, the strategy of the mind to deal with that is desire. You know, let's get food. That'll, you know, just comfort food or something. Sometimes when we feel discomfort, the strategy is ill will. So when there's frustrated expectation, these hindrances might get born as a result. One strategy is sloth and torpor. I just give up. I'm not going to try anything anymore. Or restlessness and anxiety. You don't know what foot to stand on. Just kind of like, it's not happening. I don't know whether to go forward or backwards or what to do. Should I give up the expectation? Should I not give up the expectation? Or then doubt, I guess, similarly. So I think they can all, you know, attachment to expectation is a big source of suffering. Does that respond well enough? Yes.
number of months ago, you gave a talk, and it contained one of those antidotes, and it's had sort of almost a magical mantra kind of effect on Kundalini hindrance. What I've noticed is that Kundalini hindrance is often a sense of false certainty. Stock market. I feel happier if I take that stock. I feel happier if I have that house. I feel happy if that person hadn't done that thing. There's this false certainty. And you gave a talk where you urged the form of I don't know. Somehow when I remember to do that, it serves to dissolve that false certainty that underlies the hindrance. I've often wondered why it is. I don't know why it is, but it just seems to work.
One of the antidotes to the hindrances is to understand their danger. It's kind of, you know, ancient language to talk about the danger of them. But again, if you reflect on, you know, being gripped in a very powerful hindrance, you can see the danger. But they're kind of fragmenting forces. They prevent us from being whole and complete. And so it's, you know, it's not so healthy, or it's kind of dangerous to be fragmented. Desire fragments, you know, ill will fragments, certainly restlessness fragments, doubt fragments, keeps us kind of split and scattered in different ways. And part of the function of meditation is to unify us, to bring us together, to harmonize us, so we no longer have these scattered psyches that are going off in all kinds of directions. Desire scatters us or fragments us by going outside of ourselves often. Ill will, you know, has its own ways of operating. Okay. We have maybe time for one more, if anybody has anything else. Yes?
I noticed that my mind was what I call in judgment or evaluation, as a hindrance. I would call it a hindrance.
Yeah.
How would that fit into one of the hindrances?
So the mind is caught, your mind is caught sometimes in the whirlwind of judgment and evaluation. It's hard to know without more detail, but sometimes judgments can be part of aversion. They're kind of often, sometimes judgments, when people are troubled by judgments, judging, it's usually because they're judging things negatively, harshly or critically, and there's kind of ill will built in there. Often it's, not always, often it's a form of self-protection. So sometimes it's more useful to turn the attention away from what we're judging to the fear that, or the desire for self-protection that might be there. It can also be, evaluation can also be, as a hindrance, we're caught by it, can also be a form of doubt, uncertainty. You know, and we don't know what to do. And so we're wondering and evaluating and thinking and cogitating over and over again. Those are some thoughts I have. So, yes.
Today isn't a temple cleaning day.
Oh, it isn't?
No, that was put down long, I guess.
I put it on. I'm sorry.
Today's the fourth. Today's the fourth Sunday.
But we don't do it. We don't do it.
We do the first and third.
Yeah, it's the first and third. Okay.
You want to do it? Let's just do it anyway.
No, that's
the reason is because we want to have a community meeting
here. Oh, in here.
And so it'd be, you know, some people feel more like coming in here.
Oh, okay. So, those of you who are inspired to stay and do help with the temple cleaning, we're very grateful for that inspiration. Inspiration goes a long way, and we're all gladdened and happy by that. And rather than going to the cleaning, if you'd like to stay instead for the little community meeting, it's kind of informal. It's mostly, I don't think the board members have anything particular they want to present, but it's a kind of time to meet the board and have questions and concerns and stay as long as you'd like. So that'll happen in here, so just stay or come back after going to the bathroom or something. And so thank you. And so we'll do those over the next while, not next week, but the following 5 weeks we'll do the hindrances. So it would be very helpful if each of you just wait and hold off your particular hindrance for that week. So you know, do desire 1 week and ill will the other week. So we're all on track together, because if you're doing different hindrances in different weeks than what we're talking about, I'll get confused and you'll get confused. So do your best. Thank you.